Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering chapters 17 and 18 of Chamber of Secrets, The Heir of Slytherin, and Dobby's Reward. In these chapters, Harry takes out a giant serpent like a boss, and Lucius Malfoy is revealed to be the instigator of all the chaos of this book. Shocker.
That actually did kind of surprise me, but anyway.
Again, to be discussed. Yeah. And joining us this evening is my sister, Holly, a fellow Potterhead and bookworm. Hi, Holly.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
You can listen to Holly and I blabber on about the Jane Austen novels. Be sure to check out Sublimely Austen wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, we are discussing Harry Potter. So, Jess, what was it like reading these chapters for the first time ever?
Well, I think our listeners know well enough that I'm completely ignorant of the Harry Potter world. I didn't grow up reading Harry Potter. Kind of came out later in life, so all this is relatively new for me. I am always shocked about how dark things are in this book. This ending especially, Harry's covered in blood and all kinds of things are going on, so I wasn't surprised at the big old snake, because we knew that was coming. But I was a little surprised that Lucius Malfoy set this up a little bit. I just think it's so strange that these adults want to mess with kids to the extent of that they have been, especially ones whose parents are no longer living. So it was weird, but good.
Yeah. Holly, what was it like revisiting these two chapters, and more specifically, why did you want to choose these chapters to come on the show out of all the chapters options I gave you?
So rereading the two chapters, it was a little strange because, I've reread Harry Potter many, many times, so I didn't reread the whole book just for this, but I did pick it up and just read the two chapters we're doing, and I've never done that before with Harry Potter, like start somewhere, not the beginning. And they seemed really short, like without all the, lead up to it. Like as I was reading chapter 17, like the fight with the snake is like really fast, like it's super short. And I don't think it ever struck me as being short before. I think it's just, because I just picked it up cold and read these two. But I guess the reason I chose to do these last two chapters is because you talked about before this tends to be ranked the lowest in terms of people's favorites amongst all the other Harry Potter books, and I don't know, it just feels like this wrap up at the end of this book kind of feels like the last innocent wrap up, if that makes sense. A little bit like most, like pretty much the loose ends are all tied up. You still kind of have this, monster of the week type of thing going on for each book. I feel like things start getting a little more nuanced and complicated after this one. So, I think that's why people don't tend to rank it high. But at the same time, like you guys were saying, like there are some pretty dark things and some important things that kind of wrap up in these last two chapters in terms of, Harry confronts Lucius, who's an adult. I don't think I would have done that when I was 12.
Right.
So yeah, it's just kind of a, like I said, kind of the last sort of clean wrap up with like some important things just in the two chapters that set a tone for, I think, the rest of the book.
Yeah, a clean wrap up as we wipe blood off the sword.
Right.
That was pretty intense. Well, I mean, if this is like, Holly, if this is innocent in ending and like what, or then I keep hearing I'm in store for some pretty intense stuff. And I think, you know, and again, asterisk, I haven't read the other books, but this was plenty enjoyable. So I was like, well, I don't really know why this one gets so much, so much hate, but apparently I'll find out soon.
What it kind of reminds me of, Amy, or either of you, did you guys read the series of Unfortunate Events
books? I got up to book 10 or 12, and then I stopped.
Okay.
I never did.
Yeah, I haven't read them myself either. I know there was a show, but like my impression of that book series was that, you know, it's pretty dark, and yet it's still supposed to be kind of comical at the same time, you know?
Yeah, I can see. You know, again, I've read some of the books. Yeah, and I can guess I see that in certain elements, again, like following Harry Potter, the earlier versions had more darker,
like it's deciding like what kind of book it's going to be like at this point, you know? That's
Yeah. And just for a series of unfortunate events, like I got to a point where I stopped this series because I felt like it was just a whole bunch of, you know, never ending, you know, dark nonsense that wasn't tying into anything or wasn't creating a bigger picture. So I'm just like, okay, I'm no longer invested.
Yeah.
That one never appealed to me because of the level of darkness I think that I had heard it went into. I never watched the show, but I saw the, you know, like the trailers and I kind of went, not for me. So I don't know. It just
same.
Yeah.
So chapter 17, The Heir of Slytherin. So ultimately, Harry has entered the heart of the Chamber of Secrets with the big pillars, with snakes carved on them, the big statue of Salazar Slytherin, yada, yada, yada. And what, Jess, what'd you think about poor lifeless Ginny on the floor?
Well, I think it was, again, you know, my constant shock about how dark this is. Like, he's essentially like sucking her soul out and, you know, making her so weak. I thought this was pretty intense. She wasn't petrified, so, you know, they kind of rule that out pretty quickly. And then Harry's just desperate to wake her up. And then, of course, our good friend Tom Riddle shows up.
So, you know, it just, you know enough from pop culture that you knew who Tom Riddle was, but you didn't know quite how he worked in the specific plot of Chamber of Secrets. So reading the final chapters, how did you feel about everything?
You know, I did think it was pretty interesting the way they brought him into the story, that it wasn't full on Voldemort, but it's, you know, the memory of Tom. And I thought this was really well done, to be quite honest. I thought it was really interesting how he appeared kind of shadowy and in the, like, what did they say? They were looking at him through a misty window, but there was no mistake. It was Tom Riddle. So I thought it was an interesting way to introduce that character, aside from, you know, just being the person responding with the diary. So I liked it. I mean, I thought it was interesting, and I thought this whole scene again was pretty intense, especially if we're talking about like killing a young girl and how they're tricking her. And then I just thought this just kept getting darker. I was like, okay, what's the age range on this book again? Like, what is going on? So
yeah. So as Holly rightly stated, the fight between the snake and Harry is pretty short. The majority of this chapter is Tom Riddle doing his bad guy monologuing.
Yeah, even his monologuing is not as long as I remember. But
that's a great way to like encompass this chapter, Amy, because he really did, like, I was like, all right, this is the Tom Riddle chapter where he's telling his whole history. And I kind of was like, if I was Harry, I would be like, dude, all right, let's get on with this. There's this giant, you know, like let's move on. But whatever, he's got to tell his story to set the foundation for later. So I get it.
Yeah. It takes a little while for Harry to catch on that Tom is not his buddy.
Yeah.
I feel like the part where, you know, and actually, so here's what's kind of weird for me about this book also. I mean, I've reread it a lot at this point, but I don't know how or why this happened. But when I was first reading this series, I didn't start right away. I remember I was starting like when the third book came out, or somehow I had ordered the three books, I think. And Philosopher's Stone came, Prisoner of Azkaban came, but Chamber of Secrets was backordered. So I actually read Philosopher's Stone, Prisoner of Azkaban, and then I went back and read Chamber of Secrets. So I read them out of order the very, very first time I read them.
Oh, did you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, which has always been a bit of a strange thing. So like some things that happen in like book three, you know, I knew about when I was reading this book. So that made it kind of weird. Although I will say there, I think book three does a good job of not, like if you did do that, which I wouldn't recommend, but there were some things that were still surprises when I read this book. And I think, I don't know, I feel like everyone in the world gasped when they read the part where, you know, he rearranges the letters, you know, like to you know, Tom Marvolo Riddle, and then he rearranges the letters to you know, I am Lord Voldemort. And I just feel like that moment for everybody was like, oh.
But for you, that was taken by Prisoner of Azkaban?
No, I still felt bad about like that particular thing. But I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, there's some things that happen at, you know, in Prisoner of Azkaban that kind of, you know, it's just more information, changes a few, you know, perspective on a few things, you know, reading this. So I never had like a completely naive read through of Chamber of Secrets, which is a weird thing.
I think that reveal, I agree with you, Holly. I think that reveal is really cool, and it's a cool way to go about it. Though I was like, I did the thing where I'm like, was I supposed to know his middle name was Marvolo or whatever? Like, did I skip past it? I don't think I did, but I do remember, because this is like one of the, I mean, how long have these books been out? Of course, I'm going to have some spoiled reading of this and various surprises on others, it seems. But I kept trying to figure out how Thomas Riddle spelled out I am, or Voldemort, because I was like, I knew there's something in there. So I was glad that this happened. But Harry's reaction seems a little restrained compared to what, I mean, I think it would, I guess how I would have reacted. I don't know. I guess his voice was quiet and full of hatred is kind of like the extent of anger that we get from Harry.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry, I was just letting Bacon out.
Aw, oh. Hi, Bacon.
I know in the movies, the way they have I don't know the actor's name, but the way they kind of portray, you know, the Tom Riddle memory is he's a little bit more angry. In the books, I feel like he's a lot more calm, collected, like almost amused. So I think Harry's just completely like blindsided, well, almost like shocked, you know, like doesn't like, how do you react to that after, you know, it's just right. Like a double take. Well, what?
Right.
Yeah. So with Tom Riddle's bad guy monologue, just not first one to come up with this, but again, just how gross and predatory the diary's grooming of Ginny is.
Yeah. Good point. That is very manipulative of a girl. She's like 11 or 12 at this point. She's
11.
Young. Okay. Yeah. Not the creepy factor of that, like beyond just,
I'm glad you brought that up. The creepy guy in the chat room that you don't know who they are.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a pretty mature theme actually, even though this is one of the earlier books, you know, the lesson of, I know there's a quote from Arthur Weasley later, but yeah, like trusting information from an unknown source and, you know, someone who pretends to be your friend, but, you know, someone who you've never met before. This can be a very, very dangerous thing.
Right.
Yep. And then when he finally does reveal, his sort of, you know, anagram, I am Lord Voldemort. He says, "You see," he whispered, "it was a name I was already using at Hogwarts to my most intimate friends only, of course. You think I was going to use my filthy muggle father's name forever? I, in whose veins runs the blood of Salazar Slytherin himself through my mother's side? I keep the name of a foul, common muggle who abandoned me even before I was born just because he found out his wife was a witch? No, Harry, I fashioned myself a new name I knew wizards everywhere would one day fear to speak when I had become the greatest sorcerer in the world." And again, thinking, daddy issues.
Yeah. Gosh. How did he predict that Voldemort would have such weight? Like, do we ever learn I am not a linguist, so is there some sort of additional meaning that I'm not seeing with the name Voldemort?
Voldemort is actually French for vol, flight, and then more is death, so literally flight from death.
Okay.
Yeah, which is kind of part of Voldemort's overarching, like, I'm so powerful, I shouldn't have to die, so he chases immortality. Hence, he was trying to get a hold of the Philosopher's Stone.
Right, okay. I'm just trying to digest this information of he kind of is telling his tale and then makes the connection that he and Harry are, you know, they've got some similar backstories. So pretty exciting there for both of them, right? Yeah. Not really, but.
Yeah.
Yep. Exciting for the readers for thematic purposes, of course.
Right.
Both raised by crappy muggles who didn't care about them and, yeah, all those things.
But I think he is... I mean, this is one point in the book where I think he is, like, the book Riddle is angry because, you know, you can tell he really, really resents, you know, his muggle-born father.
So that made me ask the question, and it made me think of, and this is, you know, we talked about the muggle prejudice and things like that. It reminded me of a very famous, like, sketch from the Dave Chappelle show about the Black Klansman, where he's being, you know, like he's part of the KKK and he's blind and he doesn't realize that, you know, he's Black. So I was thinking about the level of self-hatred, I guess, is that what Riddle's experiencing? Because he's talking about how he's just totally sickened by his half muggleness. So is he just trying to, I mean, I don't know if I'm complicating this more or just confusing myself, but I kind of got a little bit of self-loathing in this, in his previous monologue as well.
Yeah, that is not an unusual take on him because, yeah, people have gone on to say that part of his pure blood ideology, of course, stems from, again, his muggle father abandoning him. And I think I ranted about it in detail in our Gothic Elements in Harry Potter on Sublimely Gothic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's just the sense of how you interpret, like, magic. Because, you know, you could have someone, like, a villain who hated muggles, but didn't necessarily hate muggle-born wizards and witches. You know, that'd be like, okay, as long as you have the power, like, you're good, but all other non-magical people, you know, they're bad. You could have a supremacist in that way, but the way this villain and this prejudiced world works is that it's not just having the power, it's also having a very specific type of pedigree. And if you have muggle blood and have power, then you're cheating.
Okay.
Well, but, yeah. Voldemort's cheating in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
We'll learn later, but...
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Yep. And... who comes to Harry's aid but Fox? What'd you think of Fox showing up, Jess?
Well, I thought of Kevin from The Fox and the Foxhound. And then I also thought, I mean, I love a phoenix. That's just the coolest thing. So good on Fox showing up. My other question was, had it been any other student, would Fox have shown up? And how did he know? And then I learned that later. You know, how Fox knew to come help him out. But Fox takes no prisoners here in this situation. It's pretty brutal how he takes down the basilisk.
Yeah, he basically blinds the basilisk where blood's dripping on the floor from his gouged eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't remember how violent, because I think when I'm reading the whole book, you know, I just kind of go through it quickly, and I've read, you know, again, sometimes I even just gloss over stuff because I know what's happening. But here, like, trying to focus on the words, because, you know, I'm also, like, looking for quotes and stuff. And it's just, like, Harry gets, like, pushed against the wall. Like, he brings the hat to Harry, right? And then, like, Harry stumbles, Fox, like, takes off from his shoulder and, like, literally, like, gouges out the eyes. Massive snake. It's just like, oh, my God.
Yeah, like how the mountain takes out the red viper.
Oh, God.
Oh, good gosh. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a great image.
Yeah. No.
That makes me cringe. I hated that scene so much.
Yeah,
I did too.
Again, I make lots of Game of Thrones references on this
podcast. Oh my gosh, and his name is, you know, the Viper. Coincidence?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is a coincidence.
Yeah, with the eyes gouged out, you know, Harry can actually stand somewhat of a chance, but still he's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And so he shoves the sorting hat on, and he almost gets knocked out by the sword's hilt.
Yeah, he's, like, asking for help. He doesn't know what to do.
Go ahead, Jess.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have either. And this was really, I kind of didn't know where this was going. So I was surprised that his sword came flying out of the hat.
Yeah, I'm in the midst of drafting a video essay for how chivalry plays into Game of Thrones. Yeah, so just thinking about all that stuff and researching that stuff made me think about, you know, Harry now has the sword of Gryffindor, and so the ultimate tying in of all the Arthenian notions of chivalry and valor, and they're being embodied in Harry.
That is a very, I don't know a lot about King Arthur, the tales or whatever. I've always thought it would do me well to read that and then kind of have some more foundation for some of this. But I do like that tie-in. And I also thought, as soon as that sword came out, I was like, okay, now we're kind of doing a little hat tip or whatever to some of those stories. And honestly, again, I am always surprised at the level of violence and darkness in this. And I'm like, why? It is, of course, it's a sword. It's not something like a little bag of magic, you know, powder to throw on a snake. It's a full on sword. So that surprised me.
Yeah, sprinkle it with fairy dust.
Hey, you know, I keep going, this is a kid's book. What's going on here? So, yeah, it surprised me.
Yeah, something I just thought of is, you know, Tom Riddle, the pseudo-memory, has Harry's wand. So I assume he's corporeal enough to hold it, but he can't use it? I'm not sure.
I don't know, because it says that, you know, even after Fox heals Harry, like, there is this implication that I'll just finish you off so that... I thought we were supposed to, like, he'd finally got corporeal enough that he could possibly kill Harry with a wand.
Yeah, I think he also just enjoys the sport of watching Harry suffer, so.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't know what to think of that, because they always describe him, he was more solid than Ghost, but again, it was like seeing him through a frosted window, so he wasn't fully there, but could take the wand and... certainly was in a position where it didn't seem like, even if Harry tried, that he would have been able to, like, wrestle the wand away from Tom.
Right. Yeah, I wondered that as well, because...
Or maybe he could, and Tom Riddle was just totally BSing.
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
That is perfectly possible.
Yeah, because when Fox is attacking, I think he does react. No, he's not just standing there. Like, I think he's trying to, like, wave Fox away somehow. But not casting spells, I don't think. So yeah, maybe he can't actually use it yet. By the way, Fox, like the name Fox, I think, is that for Guy Fox?
Is it? I don't know.
I don't know either, but I, you know, like the whole fire.
Yeah.
Connection. The whole fire thing.
Yeah.
There is that Harry Potter philosophy book where one of the essays is about, like, how much of Dumbledore is a super, like, libertarian, and then, like, freedom, individual freedom above everything else. So that would make sense that Fox would be after Guy Fox if we follow that interpretation of Dumbledore.
I just did a Google search for Fox to see which would come up first, and I don't know if it's because it's from my account, but Fox, the Harry Potter character, comes up way before Guy Fox. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, Harry is able to shove the sword into the roof of the basilisk's mouth, but ends up getting...
It's so quick. In the movie, there's like this long chase scene and stuff. And I feel like that kind of colors people's memories about it. And again, when you're reading through the whole thing, there's like a whole buildup. But just like this chapter alone, it's like he gets the sword, he immediately takes it, and like it's almost like instant. He just thrusts it at it.
Yeah. Yep.
And with leaving a big fragmented piece of fang in his forearm.
Yeah, that's a little intense. I also thought, well, okay, obviously the snake is apparently not venomous because it's not like seeping through his body unless I just totally read over it, but it just kind of jabs him.
Yeah, well, it is poisonous. And, you know, Riddle was just waiting for Harry to die, but then the poison was circumvented by Fox's tears.
Which, this part kind of bothered me more than it should, is that it took Riddle so long to, like, figure out what Fox was. I was like, come on, man. You know this is a phoenix. Like, you know, he does nothing to, like, get the bird away from him.
He says, right, phoenix tears, healing powers, I forgot. Or something like that.
I was like, did you though? This is, I don't know. For
you
some
think
reason,
he would have remembered. That. He's very powerful.
He's very powerful, but we also think that this is the 16-year-old version of Voldemort, not the adult one that Harry came to know in Philosopher's Stone.
I mean, I should be a little less judgy because I can barely remember my name like most days, so I should probably chill the judgment.
Oh, so yeah, maybe he doesn't have all of adult Voldemort's knowledge. I never thought of that before.
I interpreted it as he has significantly more blind spots than like it would be if Harry was facing off, you know, another quarrel with Voldemort again.
Okay.
Harry is able to defeat this Voldemort because it's a younger version who has certain lapses in knowledge and he defeated Philosopher's Stone Voldemort because Voldemort was so dependent on the corporeal piggybacking on Quirrell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep.
But this next part is like also pretty quick. Like, I think you said something one of the earlier episodes, because I listened to all of them, and I don't remember what the conversation was about, but, you know, it was kind of pointing out that, you know, Hermione is, you know, pretty bright. It was probably in Philosopher's Stone when they land in the Devil's Snare, you know. Harry's really, really good at thinking on the spot, under pressure, like in the thick of things. He's very, very good at that. You know, in a way that maybe the others aren't, which is why he makes it through so many scrapes, right? But like the book, the diary falls in front of him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like he instantly is just like, oh, I'm gonna take this fang out of my arm and stab the book with it, like without, you know, with like barely any pause, you know. It's kind of crazy. Like, I don't know if I would have thought to do something like that.
Yeah, again, Harry the writer, you know, who wrote these as memoirs. That's how we're going with this podcast.
Of course.
Yeah, maybe Harry the writer should have maybe just added a few more sentences of, you know, Riddle came from the diary and is not fully corporal, so what would happen if I destroyed the diary?
Yeah.
It's like he thinks all that like at like lightning speed, right? Without realizing it.
Yeah, it's instinctual in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
And it pays off because Tom Riddle screams and writhes around and vanishes.
It spews out ink like blood is the description.
Yeah, which I think was pretty badass, but
It definitely is. It's just like I'm constantly surprised at the level of, you know, kind of gore. Not that this is super gory by any means, but just the level of blood and stuff like that that does come out throughout this. But I don't know.
And because the diary is destroyed, Ginny can finally wake up. And personally, I think it's, you know, you would think that having her soul nearly ripped out her life form, however this was gonna work, if, you know, she would be in a position to even walk at this point.
I guess, like, that's part of the thing that, because she kind of got, came to so quickly. I'm just so used to other portrayals of situations similar, it being a little more, you know, you kind of have to take time to get your, get kind of your strength back. And this was pretty, this all happened pretty quick.
That's magic.
It's, yeah. It is. It's magic.
It's the answer to everything. It's magic.
Yes.
It's magic.
Yeah, I mean, this chapter, you know, I mean, it's quick. It was very quick for me, like, not having read the previous stuff going up to it. But, I mean, you know, it's very much just an action chapter. I mean, there's things about, you know, Tom Riddle's speech that have, you know, if we had all read the rest of the books, like, we could talk about some of the other, like, implications of things he's saying. But, you know, without giving that away, yeah, I mean, it's pretty, this whole chapter is just like the action chapter, pretty much.
Yeah, the action chapter. And I guess one thing I will say is then going back to, again, the Athenian stuff of Harry with the sword, what does it say about the symbolism of the battle or rivalry between Gryffindor and Slytherin, that it's Gryffindor's sword that's used to kill Slytherin's creature? And how does that tie into, again, the later sort of doubt that Harry has about his own placement within the house sorting system?
Yeah.
They discuss that in, you know, I think Dumbledore in the next chapter just kind of puts that to rest. You know, like, look, you pulled this, you know, this is the sword of Godric Gryffindor. Like, only a true Gryffindor could have pulled that out of the hat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With a twinkle in his eye.
Yeah.
Always.
Yep. And so, yeah, Ginny comes round and they're able to make it back to where Ron was. Ron has shifted some of the rocks and Gilderoy Lockhart, his memory charm has backfired and hasn't got a clue who he is.
This is, again, I'm like, I don't know how I feel about this. I kind of was a little bummed because I kind of wanted Lockhart to remember some of this stuff. But was he using Ron's wand? I don't remember if he was.
Yeah, so basically the whole reason the charm backfired on him was because he was using Ron's faulty wand.
Let's get that kid a new wand. Goodness, I don't know what's going on here. That's causing a lot of problems. What's going on?
Yeah, I think what is kind of, you know, we have these confrontations with Lucius in, I mean, we'll have one later in a bit, but, you know, also kind of going against an adult who seems like a good adult, but is also actually corrupt. You know, that's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, for this book, again, I know people, it is a little bit more innocent in a sense, I guess, but that's another kind of more mature theme. Like, adults aren't necessarily trustworthy, you know, like, even ones who seem nice, like, they may hurt you. You know, so yeah, I also go back and forth, like, do I feel kind of bad for him, for Gilderoy? Like, I don't know. I kind of agree that if he hadn't lost his memory, then, you know, he could stand trial or something for,
yeah, well, know, it's attacking, I think, it's kids. What do we think of as an appropriate form of culpability? It's a sense of poetic justice that Dumbledore stated, fallen on your own sword, that he himself is a victim of his own memory charms, which is what he has been using to create problems for the world. But in a lot of ways, that is a very benevolent, quote-unquote, merciful form of comeuppance that doesn't make him, you know, psychologically deal with the consequences of, like, being finally brought to justice and knowing that he got caught and that his reputation is ruined and all of those things.
I guess I didn't expect, and maybe, you know, for this book exclusively, I don't know what happens if he comes back at any point or whatever. I guess I didn't expect him to not have some sort of connection to Voldemort or have some sort of other kind of, one of my favorite words, nefarious intent throughout this, which honestly I appreciate, because it's just like some people just kind of act like that. They're flawed, but they're not necessarily, you know, kind of like what you talked about, Holly. They're not the Voldemort level.
They've got their own agenda, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So you like the fact that Gilderoy was more of just, you know, his own person doing his own, again, not morally good thing, but not the big evil like Snape, rather than becoming another Quirrell.
I guess like I kind of expected it to be like Quirrell again, you know, that there was some sort of allegiance to the Dark Lord and that would, you know, that's what all of his shenanigans were. And that kind of frustrated me, like, but as we're talking about this, I appreciate the, like you said, the poetic justice of it more and just kind of the acknowledgement that some people aren't always on the level of 100% evil. Some people are just, you know, in it for themselves and like that. So,
yeah, he was kind of a red herring, I think, at a couple points, right? Because I know this isn't this chapter, but like, doesn't Harry like first hear the voice when he's in detention, like signing autographs?
Oh, yeah.
With him or something. Like, there were some things to suggest, like, you're supposed to think, what's that Gilderoy up to? He seems way too positive to, like, be actually like that. And that's right, like, but it's not related to anything else. He's just a, you know, a
charlatan.
Yeah, out here doing his own thing.
Right.
Yeah, and I think I was trying to lead Jess astray, you know, when Harry's room got ransacked. And I'm like, what if it's a teacher?
I don't even remember what I said, but now I know you're up to some trickery, Amy.
Yeah, but it turns out, yeah, that it was Ginny who, like, I'm curious about, yeah, just that whole dynamic that makes me think of, you know, Ginny took the diary back, so she knew it was evil. So did Tom Riddle have enough power to just totally take her over again? Because you would think it would. I don't know. Yeah. Someone needs to write that fanfic of Ginny's first year at Hogwarts.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. That really did surprise me, too, that it was her. I did not see that coming, really. So,
yeah. If you go through the, you know, podcast or just reading the book, Jess, I deliberately, you know, would read out certain lines that would point to Ginny and her peculiar behavior.
Well, it just tells me,
and it totally went over you, like, even
it goes over everyone's head. I mean, you know, when you reread it, it's like you see Jenny being distressed in like random moments, and it's like, I know what that's all about. But first time, it's like, you know, she's just there, she's Ron's sister and she's a first year, and like, why pay her any attention?
Yep. So Fox pulls them all out of the Chamber of Secrets, and that ultimately concludes chapter 17.
Good action-packed chapter. I mean, I'll take one of those over a Quidditch chapter any day.
Yeah, Jess has no love for the Quidditch chapters, Holly.
I really don't.
Hopefully, well, I mean, not hopefully, but there are various ways and means that the Quidditch gets avoided.
Yes.
You know, just so we don't have to keep reading that over and over again.
Good.
Yep. Now we have chapter 18, Dobby's Reward. And basically they have the whole explanation spiel in, not Dumbledore's office, but McGonagall's office. Yeah.
Right, because Dumbledore is like, he's been gone from the school, like the school governors like asked him to leave, right? So they don't even know he's going to be there. So they're like bringing Ginny and Lockhart to McGonagall.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. and Mrs. Weasley are already there.
Right, because they had this horrible news that Ginny was missing. I like how this scene played out. I really liked it. And I like, of course, how Dumbledore kind of can sense the nervousness of Ron and Harry thinking that Ginny might be expelled for kind of these troubling situations, but he very astutely, just because he's Dumbledore and he's awesome, says, you know, what interests me most is how Lord Voldemort managed to enchant Ginny when my sources tell me he is currently hiding in the forests of Albania. So
yeah.
Good on, yeah. Dumbledore, always. Yeah.
And I really didn't like, you know, obviously it's coming from concern or fear or apprehension or whatever, but I didn't like how Mr. Weasley immediately goes into, like, critical mode of Ginny. Because this is, like, you know, again, the supposedly one of the worst dark wizards of the 20th century, and he's harping on Ginny that she couldn't, like, outfox him.
I thought that was really surprising, that, you know, compared to the Mr. Weasley that we met at the beginning of the book, and maybe that's the reason he took that turn because of all that wild flying car stuff. But that surprised me. I was like, dude, chill. What happened to you?
Yeah. And I think it's just by the nature of his job is all about like disenchanting objects.
Mm.
So he's coming from a very clouded bias view of to always, he's constantly nonstop viewing the like certain objects with suspicion and thinks everyone views the world that way, but not necessarily and particularly not an 11-year-old girl.
Right. I thought it was a little bit of posturing in front of Dumbledore and the Hogwarts people too. But I think like what you said, Amy, his experience with these things and knowing how bad it can be is what clouded him.
I could have sworn that Molly said those lines that Arthur says, because that seems like a more Molly type of thing, you know?
Yeah. No, it was Arthur Weasley.
I had to like backtrack a little bit when, and I was like, wait, was that Arthur?
I did.
Because, yeah.
I did as well, because I felt like that was, I was like, that's Mrs. Weasley getting mad about the, you know, little gnomes in the garden, not Mr. Weasley getting mad at his daughter. So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so, you know, Mrs. Weasley goes on to take Ginny to the hospital wing. Dumbledore gets rid of McGonagall, saying, go prepare the feast.
Get out of here, McGonagall. Yeah.
And then how does he banish Ron? How does he get rid of Ron?
Ron takes Gilderoy to the infirmary.
Oh, okay, yeah.
After Dumbledore gives Ron and Harry 200 points.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's ultimate. I've seen so many memes about, again, like, just whatever, and then it shows Dumbledore, like, 100 points to Gryffindor, and I'm like, was he really that bad? And I didn't perceive him, because it was, like, 50 each for all the Philosopher's Stone stuff, and so now, like, okay, you've upgraded, you went from Philosopher's Stone to Changer of Secrets, so you get 200.
And special, it's like an award for special services to the school, that they also get awarded. I mean, again, you know, Dumbledore, you guys will get more into this as the series progresses, but, you know, we're supposed to see Dumbledore as this very wise and intelligent and just, you know, like he can see through all the situations and see the stuff that people are trying to pull. But, like, he's not 100% responsible. You know, like, if you're the headmaster and your kids are running off into like dark, dangerous chambers and all you do is, you know, reward them instead of like, you know, question why didn't you find an adult? Well, I think maybe Ron and Harry had this conversation. Didn't they try to find an adult and couldn't?
I think that's the thing. It's like they did find an adult, but the adult was incompetent.
Yeah, situation. There's so many teachers, though. Like, any teacher.
Yeah.
Sprout, somebody. You know, anybody. Didn't have to be Gilderoy, but...
True. And then it's here that we have the big sort of nature versus nurture discussion, where, again, Harry is airing his, you know, self-doubt about, you know, this kind of pull between Gryffindor and Slytherin.
I liked this a lot. I thought it was really an interesting conversation, way to tell the story. And I really liked how, you know, he's very concerned about being part of Slytherin because he's like, well, I can speak, you know, Parseltongue. Like, obviously there's something up. And it is explained that Voldemort, obviously obvious to Dumbledore, not me, but put a bit of himself in him when, you know, that fateful night. So I just thought that was a really cool exchange. And I am totally 100% a Dumbledore fangirl. So any exchange with Dumbledore is going to be cool with me. But I thought this was really interesting. I enjoyed this part of this chapter a lot.
I liked this part in the sense of course, directly comparing Harry to Tom Riddle and saying that, you know, Riddle came from a similar unhappy background as you, but still he, you know, chose to make bad, he chose bad decisions, whereas you've come from a similar negative background and you didn't make bad choices. So I like the direct comparison between, again, the hero and the villain. But I don't like, again, going into the whole, like, again, demonization of all of Slytherin House. And, you know, we kind of went over that in depth in the scholarly Slither clause when we were comparing the houses with the elements. Yeah, that so
the entire house is bad. Yeah, it seems a little strange.
Yeah, well, the idea that, you know, it's our choices that make us who we are. And so implying that to choose Slytherin would have been a bad choice.
Right.
So that's the...
I still appreciate, I mean, this whole idea of, you know, it's our choices who define us, not our abilities. I think it's a very important overall theme for the whole series. So I feel like this is a very important moment for Harry to, like, realize this. Like, just because things seem similar doesn't mean he's bad, you know, like, that's not what's important. So I think that's all really good about this scene. But yeah, like you said,
I like it. I like it too. I just don't like the inflation of the houses to the level of, you know, directly comparing Harry with Riddle. And again, it just, again, goes into the whole, and it's hard. It's not, you know, it makes sense why Slytherin has been inflated to evil at this point, because one of the major tenets of Tom Riddle and Voldemort's identity is that they are he's the last descendant of the Slytherin, like, bloodline.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that, you know, and I think this is from, again, pop culture knowledge of Harry Potter. I kind of always knew, like, the Hufflepuff house was kind of like, I knew that was my house before I even took the quiz, you know, because it was kind of like the softies. And this is just from, you know, the outsider perspective. And the Slytherins were kind of like, gross, get away from me. But Dumbledore says, you know, his own rare gift, Parseltongue, he talks about kind of some of the positive things that I think are related to Slytherin. The more I've come to know this story, resourcefulness, determination, a certain disregard for the rules. I'm not saying that that's a good thing, but, you know, it's, I guess, the resourcefulness and the determination were the kind of like attributes that Salazar Slytherin selected. There's a lot of S's in his people. And, you know, I think it's good to kind of contrast Harry's using some of those things for noble reasons where Tom Riddle was not really doing it at all.
Yep. And it goes on to show that Gryffindor and Slytherin are actually quite similar. It's just that Slytherin is lacking the same sort of, like, rigid moral code in a way, because, like, in many ways, Gryffindor and Slytherin are similar in a way that just Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw are just totally out there with their own, like, major tenets of characteristics.
Yeah, this is, like, the whole houses, you know, this is another one of those things where, you know, right now it's a bit cartoonish, you know, like you have the Slytherin house, you have the Gryffindors. But then as we, you know, move on and it's not just, hey, there's this bad guy out there and Harry's got to save the day. You know, it's more like things happening in the government, like are adults doing what you think they're doing, you know, that sort of thing. Then you start to fall back and think, well, wait a minute. Like if that's sort of the world we're in here, you know, this is pretty messed up, like the way they sort these students. Like, is that appropriate?
Yep. But we get that whole nature versus nurture spiel, and they're about to, you know, go to the feast, and Lucius Malfoy turns up.
Ugh.
So did you know that Dobby was part of the Malfoy household?
I did know that. And I think I put that together, especially how unkind everybody is to Dobby. But for some reason, again, if I saw a movie a million years ago and completely forgot it, I don't remember. But I did know that Dobby was involved with the Malfoys in some capacity. I didn't realize that this all happened so quickly, though. I thought this took several books for Dobby to be released from their, you know, service. But so I was surprised that this is all, you know, happened in this book, because I know that, like, Spew is a thing that's coming up. So I know a little bit of that. But
yeah, but Lucius Malfoy is not happy that Dumbledore has returned. And then just got me thinking, like, okay, how did Lucius Malfoy honestly think he was going to maintain control of the Board of Governors, like 11 versus 1, for any extended period of time?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think it says towards the end of, you know, in the last few paragraphs or something, like, he's definitely, like, fired or, you know, removed from the school board because of his, you know, basically, you know,
blackmailing,
bribing. Not, is it blackmailing? I think he just threatens to curse their families or something if they don't follow his vote, you know, to...
Yeah, like, I don't know, was he... Dumbledore. I don't know, I guess the only thing I can think of to justify that was that he was hoping that, like, someone would die enough that... you can't die enough. He thought something bad enough would happen that regardless of what the other governors would have wanted at that point, that there was no way that Dumbledore could have salvaged his position.
But if Dumbledore's gone when that happens...
Yeah, and I just thought of that when I was explaining this.
That doesn't make sense. But I guess what I'm saying is I'm glad at least enough... Yeah, I'm glad they realized that Lucius is corrupt enough that this behavior, like, does cause him to lose his place on the school board or whatever. But it clearly isn't enough for him to not still be active politically, like, you know, in the future. I guess I shouldn't say more because I don't want to give anything away. But
I know that he is never not a presence, is my understanding. The only question I have for you all, and maybe this is something I'll learn later, is given, like, our conversation that we've had about Slytherins and their kind of, like, desire for purity, at least, or allegiance with Salazar Slytherin, why is he involved in this? Like, are these people elected? I have questions about a representative from each house has to be there. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it kind of goes into, like, again, the sort of insidiousness of institutional racism, where it's easy to, you know, tear down and bar the, like, you know, the neo-Nazi from public life, but these prejudices still permeate the general mainstream culture, and Lucius Malfoy is a representation of that, that he's not going committing terrorist acts, although he secretly is, and he's not going to be brought to justice for it. But again, just the idea that people in power who still hold these views are still, it's still hard to, like, knock down those pillars in society.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's all it is, really. Like, it's like real world. You know, Lucius is well connected and mm-hmm. he has money, and that's basically all it takes. You know, like, I don't know if you get, I'm just thinking of one example off the top of my head, but Elizabeth Holmes was like this person. Have you heard of her?
Oh, yeah. I was very interested in that story last.
Yeah, kind of a bummer because, you know, we see so many male, you know, entrepreneurs, and it was like such a sad thing to see, like, you know, finally this, well, not finally, there's lots of female leadership in the biotech field. But anyway, basically she, you know, dropped out of Stanford, didn't even finish college, and started this whole company. And then it turned out to be a whole, you know, like all kinds of fraud and whatnot. And, but, you know, how was she able to do this? And you think about how can someone just with no degree, especially in biotech, you know, it's not like computer science or something where, you know, if you have a computer, you can write an app for anything, right? But this is like serious, you need to know what you're doing type of stuff. And how did this happen? You know, like, her father was at Enron. They have connections with, like, Rupert Murdoch, you know, like the Koch brothers or something. Like, all these just powerful douchebags, they all know each other.
Right.
They all know each other and they all help each other just get more and more, you know, wealthy. And that's just how it works. So I'm imagining maybe a similar thing here. Lucius is one of these people.
That totally makes sense. I mean, Yeah.
And I just thought of Harvey Weinstein, just because I was watching an interview. I don't know how old it was, but just of this former female assistant that Harvey Weinstein had, like, literally 19 years ago. And she ended up trying to report or trying to, like, prosecute because she found out about the way Harvey had treated one of the actresses at a film festival. And ultimately, again, she was only 23 at the time and got, like, shut down. And, like, when she left, you know, she couldn't, like, really re-enter the industry and, you know, had to literally said like she ran off to train horses in Central America because there was nothing for her like with the film industry anymore.
Wow. That's pretty intense.
Yeah. So, but that was even like 19 years ago, where if maybe they'd taken her like story and her claims and the whole case seriously, then maybe maybe Harvey Weinstein could have been stopped, you know, much sooner in his career. But even then, 20 years ago, he was still too powerful.
Yeah.
So anyway, so yeah, that I got thinking about that with Malfoy. And then I also got thinking like basically, you know, they put it together that ultimately Malfoy was responsible for giving Ginny the diary and basically admitting that we can't prove it, but just kind of warning him, like, I wouldn't advise being all willy-nilly with any of Voldemort's possessions that he might have left you.
Yeah, and Dumbledore knows. Like, Dumbledore doesn't even need an explanation from Harry, I don't think. Like,
yeah, like, Dobby kind of keeps pointing and, like, you know, so Dobby, you know, Harry figures it out from Dobby, but, like, whether Dumbledore notices or not, but Dumbledore knows, and, again, is not taking any steps to, again, try and, like, pursue this. But I'm just thinking of poor Ginny, of the idea that for someone as powerful as Dumbledore to know that Lucius Malfoy did this, and just thinking, okay, like, I'm letting you go, Lucius, because there's, like, quote-unquote, no one died, no harm was done, but still, Ginny has to live with the, you know, reality that the person who put her through all of this is still walking around in society and schmoozing with the minister and all sorts of crap.
Right, right. You were just talking about Harvey Weinstein, so I can't help but think about, you know, some of the people that were victims of him and watching him kind of do the same things and be successful. And meanwhile, processing was this trauma, because I mean, Jenny, I hope they're getting her some like help, like, because this is some pretty heavy stuff, especially for an 11-year-old. I mean, goodness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to know what Dumbledore's power actually is. I mean, obviously, if he's at Hogwarts, that's probably the best place where he can exert some positive influence. Bless you. But yeah, I mean, usually Dumbledore just does like kind of throw shade, you know, in the way he says things. But he just outright says at this point, I mean, he's just very calm and collected as usual. But he says, you know, I would advise you not to go out giving any more Voldemort's old school things. Like, just outright says, like, yeah, I know you did this thing. Don't do it again.
Right.
There'll be worse consequences because we'll know probably that it's you and how to catch you next time.
That's like an, you know, I think I've mentioned, I've heard about Anna Wintour before. She's like one of those people, she says she doesn't yell because she doesn't have to. Like, maybe this is just, the delivery of this is just like, oh, I get it. Like, it's a serious enough, threat that it's like, okay, well, I'm done horsing around with that now. I don't know.
And it just makes me think of, again, just as we're talking about, all Malfoy has these, you know, not very nice views, but is wealthy and well-connected. Like, even with Dumbledore's power, like, how does that work of these two powerful white men going to head-to-head? Like, who would pop? With the absence of evidence, hardcore evidence, who would win in that court of public opinion?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
Because
there's
either.
People who love Dumbledore, but, you know, Lucius has plenty of people in his, like, pocket. So
yeah.
Anyway. The craziest part of all of this, I mean, we have the confrontation between Lucius and Dumbledore directly, but honestly, the thing that still strikes me the most is, like, when he storms out and Harry runs after him, and Harry's like 12. I don't know if when you guys were 12, but even if I knew an adult was like bad or not, you know, or full of crap or whatever, I don't think I would run after them and confront them about it.
I definitely would not.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't either. The only thing I can think of is that Harry is emboldened that Dumbledore knows exactly what Lucius did, that Lucius is not gonna like dare try anything in the freaking castle right outside the headmaster's office.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess if I had somebody of that like power and statute and influence and have maybe kind of like seen the things that Harry had seen, I guess maybe I would. I was still pretty shy, so
yeah. Lucius Malfoy doesn't seem all that intimidating after a giant snake.
Maybe, yeah. And a giant spider. All the giant things.
Yeah, it's true. Conditioning.
Yeah.
But again, he does something on the fly, like without thinking or barely with, you know, no planning. He stuffs the diary.
Harry the writer should have elaborated more his train of thought.
Yes.
So yeah, he thrusts the, it's a little weird because he puts the diary like in his sock, I guess. In the movie, it's like the sock is in the book, I think, in the pages of the book. But he puts this diary inside the sock and like throws it at Malfoy.
Yeah. And people go to this again, what exactly is required to set a house elf free with like the sense of intent and everything. But I can, like, I don't harp on this too much just because the idea of, you know, Lucius has been not taken to justice or having consequences, but now knows that basically he's quote unquote on metaphorical probation by Dumbledore. And so he's not thinking about, you know, being mindful of giving clothes to Dobby or having, you know, Dobby in the vicinity of any free clothes.
Right, right. I could see how he just a little distracted at this point. It is kind of a funny image to think he's, you know.
Yeah, do house elves do laundry? Like, what if you toss your laundry at them?
Oh, good point.
Who knows? There's a throwaway line that, you know, Dobby says they're always so careful, like, specifically with clothes. So, yeah, I don't know how laundry works in that way.
I need to know. It has to be in a basket or something. Like, then I know.
The non-freedom basket?
Yeah.
Hamper?
The non-freedom basket. That would probably drive some people nuts because I know that I am also guilty of some. It doesn't always make it to the laundry basket. That's the theory I'm going to go with. It has to be in the laundry basket.
Or maybe that, again, it just, the fact, even though it wasn't Malfoy's intent, you know, Malfoy, like the house elf owner, can't just, you know, throw something on the ground and then the elf pick it up later. It's in this case, Malfoy threw it and Dobby caught it. Even though that wasn't the intent, and still that was enough to break the binding spell or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Malfoy says something pretty bad here. I mean, we know he's like a corrupt, like, official, but he says something along the lines of, you'll meet the same sticky end as your parents, which is, that's pretty dark.
Yeah. Yeah, they were meddlesome fools too, which just made me think of Scooby-Doo and the meddling kids.
Yeah, well, I think in the past episodes, we've talked about some of the ways Draco talks to people and how he kind of makes these threats too, and was like wishing Hermione's death earlier on.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Exactly.
Yep. And so Dobby is free, and I didn't realize, you know, the minute Dobby is free, he could wipe the floor with Malfoy magically.
That was a surprise. He's like, as soon as he's free, he's like, now you back the F off, basically. It's like, whoa, okay. So these guys are pretty powerful creatures.
Yeah. Which again goes into my old theory of the whole origins of their enslavement probably derived from, we don't want these creatures like in competition, rival, or, you know.
Yeah, they're scared.
On so equal they, footing yeah. with any in any way, shape, or form. So they've created this whole system.
I think that theory is very apt because this is pretty, obviously he knows some magic. So good on him, Dobby. Glad.
Yeah.
I just think this whole confrontation is pretty, I just think it's pretty telling in some ways because, you know, I know Draco Malfoy is, you know, an annoyance and, you know, an antagonist that doesn't go away. But, you know, we've got Lucius, who's, you know, adult person, like, who's almost
pretty old adult too. A pretty old adult too. Like, he's older than Arthur Weasley.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like, he kind of becomes, like, more of a antagonist, maybe, even than Draco. I mean, it varies book to book, but, like, that's kind of different for, like, you know, what is a kid's story, so.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that, ultimately, we just have the typical paragraphs of closing everything up. Gryffindor wins the House Cup. They go on the train, yada, yada, yada. And yeah, that is the end.
Percy was dating Penelope Clearwater, apparently. Yes. That was the other red herring I think they kept throwing around. Percy being suspicious.
Yeah, yes. I felt like that when I saw, I was like,
oh, she did predict that one.
I did see that one. Maybe that just tells you where my mind's at most of the time. I don't know, but I saw that.
Alrighty then. So I don't know how many you have listened to, Holly, but again, this is the part where we talk about Gothic Geek Out.
Yeah, is this the part where you play the Toccata and Fugue?
Oh, yes, that is.
Okay, yeah.
I like that. I think that's really, it makes me happy with the little music. You do such a good job.
Yes. So, Jess, what did you think in terms of Gothic elements?
I had one, and then let me just kind of think about this really quick. I mean, last time you said the Chamber of Secrets was Gothic, and I feel like that one's a pretty easy Gothic one to go with, and I have to take it because it's very Gothic. I mean, all the
is Gothic.
The whole setting, all the dark things happen there. You know, we've got the giant snake, the diary, the, you know, shady person like in the shades. And I think that was going to be my original one, was going to be Tom, but I'm just going to stick with the Chamber of Secrets. To borrow yours from last week, that was pretty Gothic.
Yeah.
What about you?
I obviously veered more towards Tom or Rollo Riddle, just again to not choose the Chamber of Secrets as I did last week, because just he is a brooding. He does have elements of the brooding Gothic antagonist, or, you know, whatever. And then also, just make me think about that, also Lucius Malfoy. He's the patriarch of an upstanding pure blood family, and, you know, is the typical powerful white dude that wants to enforce his will on everyone. And so that's very Gothic.
That's very true. That's a very true.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you think of really anything, Holly?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you know, the Chamber of Secrets, a creepy hidden place in a castle, very Gothic. And then stabbing a supernatural diary to destroy a memory. That seems pretty Gothic.
That is,
you are right.
Gothic.
Yeah, especially in the case of so much of a variety of the Gothic books that Jess and I have read for Sublimely Gothic involves books that are about books.
You just made me think of Home Before Dark, as just far, I know it's not necessarily a diary, but it's like also a book that has kind of a power over the narrator.
Yeah, because we talked about Home Before Dark that involves a book, A Historian that involves a book, Shadow of the Wind that involves a book.
Hmm. Lots of books, book writers that love books, or authors that love books, which is kind of
who knew?
Right.
Alrighty then. Well, that is that, and now we can move on to Tarot of the Day.
Oh, the Death card, right? That's
no. We are.
So, do you get rid of a card each time? Is that what you're doing? Do you discard
a card? If I pull that card again, at least right now, I would pick another card.
Okay. But you have them all together.
I have them all together. But again, 78 cards, it's unlikely. Okay. Ooh. The one I pulled up is the King of Cups.
Oh, isn't that water? Isn't that water related?
Yeah, Cups is the suit that represents water.
Well, that sounds perfect.
Yeah. Why? Because Slytherin and the element is water?
Well, yeah, and then, like, you know, Voldemort's the heir of Slytherin. But again, I don't know anything about tarot. What does King of Cups mean?
Yeah, like, Lahir, I don't have it memorized. Let me just pull up a little description.
Okay.
I always thought it was kind of a good thing, and I
think it tends to be good, but yeah, just talking about water and just the idea that, you know, the Chamber of Secrets is, like, under this lake, this dark, damp place. So here, what do we got? The King of Cup represents mastery over the realms of emotion, creativity, and the unconscious. When this card turns up in a tarot reading, you have gained control of your feelings and can accept them without allowing them to get the better of you. Even when life throws you a curveball, you can draw on your emotional maturity and stability to help you navigate these challenges. You don't let things get to you, and you steer clear of the drama instead choosing an emotionally balanced and calm approach. Well, that makes me think of Tom Riddle and how he conducts himself.
Or how he controls Jenny, like controls her emotions.
Yeah, yeah, controls her very consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I guess I'll also think of Dumbledore's level-headedness too. In most situations, he doesn't really flip out. He's kind of, you know,
he's pretty chill.
Tom Riddle's kind of like a evil representation of King of Cups, and Dumbledore's kind of like a positive representation.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a king, he has a masculine fatherly energy, and as a Cups card, he brings his emotional self to the forefront. He offers wise advice when it comes to feelings, emotions, creativity, relationships, and can see the human dynamics in its entirety. Which is, yeah, makes me think of Dumbledore specifically in his little heart-to-heart about ability versus choice with Harry.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Alrighty then. Yeah, that was a good one. I'm glad I picked it. And then we also started to do, we've added, in addition to Tarot Holly, we also do the Nordic runes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I'm shaking them, figuring them out. And okay. I don't know the exact name or order of these, so just give me a minute while I pick. It's like two kind of arrows, like, sitting on top of each other. So here, let me look for the symbol. So the rune is called Yera with a J, so the old, like, you know, J as a Y. So Yera, it translates to year slash harvest. Keywords, harvest, reward, natural cycles, fruition, fertility, and growth. So Yera is the rune of harvest and of seasonal year, and of the seasonal year, which is ever turning. Similar to neo-pagan concept of the wheel of the year, Yera signifies each season of a cycle has its purpose, and so it also reminds us that the attainment of goals often takes time. A seed planted in spring must be given time to grow, and the resulting plant can only be harvested in its proper time. But provided you have put the necessary work into preparing the soil, tending the crops, and reaping the harvest, Yera indicates that your efforts will be successful. As the fourth rune in Hegel's Act, Yera follows the series of three runes which focused on obstacles. If you have been dealing with an adversary, Yera emerges as a positive sign that troubles are receding and you are moving forward in a fortuitous time of forward activity.
Hmm.
I guess that kind of makes me think of the whole confrontation with Tom Riddle in the Basilisk and the, you know, saving Jenny and kind of, I guess, you know, wrapping up that whole big, wrapping up the story, understanding why he can understand snake language, you know, I don't know. That's kind of the way I interpret that in relation to this.
Yeah, the biggest thing I think of is sort of we get the fruition of the seed of Harry's, again, doubt from the beginning about the fact that he asked to be in Gryffindor rather than the sorting hat saying it outright.
Okay.
And so that specific seed is, it still shows up in some subtle ways in the future books, but this is the part where it truly comes to rest, where Harry is like, okay, I have some Slytherin qualities, you know, even by myself, but mainly because of Voldemort's, you know, unintentional influence, but ultimately I'm a Gryffindor.
Right.
Yeah, I kind of see that, but almost like thinking about this as a beginning for the other books, like, you know, like you said, Harry has to come to terms with, like, who he is and the abilities, some of the abilities he does have. But here, you know, I feel like Dumbledore saying, you know, it's your choices that are going to matter more. And that's sort of like planting the seed of, you know, who Harry is moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Nice. Alrighty then. So let me put these away and just they make lots of noise.
Just to answer your question, Jess, there's like two things that I reread. I wish I read a more variety of things, but I'm pretty lazy. So there's two things I reread, and that's Jane Austen and Harry Potter.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Is it like a comfort thing? Do you just, is that, that's why I know a lot of people that like listen to the Harry Potter books, and they just say like when I just need some like the auditory warm blanket. I guess that's what Harry Potter is to these people.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's a story that I enjoy. I'm familiar with it. You know, it's nice to just, you know, instead of like rewatching a show I like, I'll reread Harry Potter.
Yeah. Cool. Because Holly, you know, was in a pattern of rereading Harry Potter like every 1 or every 2 years long before I was.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Interesting. So, but now we move on to fan fiction time.
Oh.
Fan fiction.
So mine was, you know, whether or not Ginny had necessarily lived or died, what would it have meant if Tom Riddle had become human? So now there are quote unquote two Voldemorts in the world.
Oh my gosh, that was one of the ones I thought of. I have several options just in case, but I thought of the exact same thing.
Yeah, because now we have there's a teenage Voldemort who is in England, and let's say he escaped. And then there's this quote-unquote spectral, not quasi-corporal one that Dumbledore says is chilling out in Albania. What happens?
Do they merge?
Would they be rivals?
I think I might have some ideas, but it's hard to say without, like, elaborating more on, like, Voldemort's whole nature. You know, like, we know there's this spectral or whatever form of him out there, the one that possessed Quirrell. But then there's this, you know, memory thing. So, I don't know. I think the memory would have become, like, if the memory becomes solid, becomes human, I just would consider that the new vessel for Voldemort.
I see.
Maybe.
Yeah. Jess, what was your scenario?
I was just trying to think through the one you posed, and I don't know. It's just too much. I was thinking, what if Fox didn't show up? Like, how would that have played out in the Chamber of Secrets? Would Harry have been, you know, because I guess if Fox didn't show up, he wouldn't have had the sorting hat. So what, I think I probably did this in the previous book too, but how would he have defeated the Basculus, it's a hard word for me to say. And, you know, how would that encounter with Tom Riddle have gone down?
Well, what I think of is without those extra resources, the only thing Harry has is that he could have talked to the snake.
Yep. Yeah. Mm. I've always wondered the same thing.
And it's like, and I would have liked if Harry would have at least tried
yeah.
to talk to it, reason with it.
That's true. Because I mean,
it was killing people, though.
It was killing people, but again, it's like, so we have this situation where we have something that's not fully corporal and fully alive. That's, you know, that has powers of, you know, Lord Voldemort, whatever. But we also have confirmation from Dumbledore that Harry possesses some elements of Lord Voldemort. So the fact that it's not neither one is a full Voldemort. They only have elements of their power. So would that have cause for a wrestle of control for the Basculisk?
And does the Basculisk have an allegiance to anybody?
It's supposed to have, again, allegiance to the heir of Slytherin, which is Voldemort. But again, Voldemort's not present currently in his entirety. And Harry is alive, you know, fully, but only as maybe a tiny sliver of Voldemort's power. But would that have been enough to, like, you know, barter the Basculus's allegiance over to him?
I don't know. I mean, also, like, does he have his wand still?
He could try to escape and go get more help, probably like he should have.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he would have made it.
Yeah. I'm excited to hear your fan fictions, Holly.
Okay, so I have three written here, and I'm glad I wrote three, because one of them was, what if Ginny had passed away and the memory became solid? So that was Amy.
Oh.
The second one is, what if Fox had not arrived? That was yours, Jess. The third one I have is, what if Harry had not managed to free Dobby?
Hmm.
Oh. Well, that would be the implication of would Lucius have noticed that that was what Harry was trying to do? And would that have made life so much more complicated and harder for Dobby?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think it's a sense of, it's not just the pride of, you know, you lost me my servant, or I lost, you know, my maid or anything. It's the idea of Dobby probably has a lot of information about Lucius's involvement with Voldemort, with the Dark Arts, with tons of stuff. So it's also, you know, a liability for Dobby to be free in a way. Right. And so, you know, and so I think, again, if Harry had failed, then that just would have made life 10 times worse for Dobby.
Yeah. You know what? You bring up a good point. And I don't know what Dobby is, you know, what he's up to in the next books, but what is preventing him from kind of airing all of the Malfoys' dirty laundry? I don't know if he does that or not, but is he just that, or are they like, is there some sort of loyalty? I would feel like there's not.
Well, if he's been ordered, I think he can't.
Yeah.
Like if they've specifically told him not to talk about it, he can't. If Lucius like specifically then asked Dobby not to ever help Harry Potter again, like, then I think he can't. I don't know. Dobby's pretty clever though. Maybe he will find a way.
Yeah. Or maybe would have followed a similar what you were originally thinking, just that Dobby gets freed several years later.
Maybe, because that's on, like I said, I really thought that happened later on. And I was like, oh, okay, it happened now. So.
Alrighty then. And thus concludes Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Next week will be our wrap-up session of a variety of questions. And Jess, I encourage you to write down your own questions to ask me as well.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yep. And again, thank you so much, Holly, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Holly. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'd like to do another one sometime, as my schedule allows.
Yeah, so we've got enough for Prisoner of Azkaban. So again, you need to pick what you want, what chapter you want in Goblet of Fire. So I'll put you down.
Goblet of Fire. Okay, will do.
Yep. Alrighty then. And thus concludes the episode. Catch you guys next week for the Chamber of Secrets wrap-up. Bye.
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 Thank you.